January, I looked at the telephone and tried not to call someone back home. For a long time, my mother would call every Sunday afternoon to catch us up on things, but really to see how we were. The first few Sundays after Nick left, when I answered the phone and heard her voice, I had to hold my hand to my mouth sometimes to keep from crying. But then I'd start lying about how well he was doing at his new job. I told her how his office was on the 17th floor of an earthquake-proof building overlooking San Francisco, and that he was making good money and would probably get promoted in no time. This used to be true. Sometimes she would want to talk to him, and I'd say he was taking a nap, and I didn't want to wake him, or else he was working. She never liked hearing that, not on a Sunday. Or he was playing basketball with some guys from his office. She seemed to like hearing that the most, that Nick was out making friends and doing something healthy. What about you, Kay? Have you made some new friends, too? Yeah, I'd say. I get together with some of the wives, and we shop and, you know, do things like that. There'd be silence on her end. And there's one girl, Ma. She's my age and kind of overweight. She lives nearby, and we go jogging together 4 nights a week. That helped. I lie about making friends and taking care of myself. As soon as she seemed satisfied with my news, she'd go on about Frank and my nephews, their house, her thinning hair, the gambling trip to Atlantic City her two sisters were planning. But behind all this talk was the question she'd never ask. Had you been going to those recovery groups out there, Kay? And that was one lie I couldn't pull off, anyway. So instead, she would finish her calls by asking me the other two questions stuck inside her like something she could only ease out by hearing me finally give the right answer. When do you think you two will have children, Kay? And for once in our calls, I could tell the truth. As soon as I can talk Nick into it, Mom, which was true when Nicky still lived with me. Saying this long after he'd been gone, though, my voice sounded hollow. Only 3 years ago, we were both into our second week at the program, and we had the same double dose, coke and alcohol. But the day before, in group, Nick had owned up to a third, porno. A lot of us couldn't accept this as a real addiction, but Larry told us to pipe down and hear, Nick. That wasn't hard for me to do, because even then, Nick's body still coming off the 10-day binge of lines and beer and southern comfort that got him into an emergency room, then the program, his fingers always trembling while he smoked. I couldn't not look at him, at those hard blue eyes, at his thick black hair and pale face with pimple scars on the cheeks. His arms and legs were skinny, and he had a belly that showed more when he sat down, but all I ever wanted to do from the start was to feel my whole wasted body up against Nicky Lazaro's. Whenever he talked, he threw me because his voice was so deep and didn't go with his boy look. And also, he spoke well, like he was educated or else read a lot of books. He said it was always worse when he was trying to stay straight, that instead of drinking or doing lines, he'd be doing dirty movies. Sometimes he even called in sick at work, and he'd rent a half dozen hardcore tapes and spend hours and hours with them. Hours? I said, and started to laugh, though I felt pretty disgusted. Larry cut me off and said how inappropriate remarks like that were in group. I looked at Nick. He was studying the burning cigarette in his hand like he wasn't part of this conversation at all. Then he glanced at me, his eyes dark and a little shiny, and my cheeks got hot, and I had to look away. On Visitor's Day, while I was waiting for my brother and his wife, I kept watching Nick on the other side of the room, sitting straight across from his parents, who reminded me of my own, though Dad was dead and Ma couldn't face seeing me anymore. Sometimes he'd glance in my direction and I'd look away. All around us were visiting families and plastic chairs around fold-out tables, some of them hardly looking into each other's eyes, others loud, telling stories and jokes like they were relieved everything had only come to this. A get-well helium balloon floating in the haze of cigarette smoke above them. But I felt grateful just to be sitting there. In the 2 weeks I'd been at the program, the lining inside my nostrils had already stopped bleeding. I hadn't drunk anything stronger than coffee, and the only stranger I would wake up to was me. But more than that, I had already stopped wanting what I'd been craving off and on since I was 15. For death, to come and take me the way the wind does a dried leaf out on its limb.
Quite early Friday morning, as I lie sleeping upon the carpet near the open sliding screen, my son touches my shoulder and wakes me to a glass of hot tea and 4 cubes of sugar. Outdoors, in the trees below us, a bird calls, but the sky is gray and the air through the screen is cool. Bobo John, Mango Khordam, I'm sorry. My son is already dressed in shorts and t-shirt, his hair dry but combed. I sit up and take the tea and drink it without sugar. I look through the screen at the small concrete terrace outside, and I hear Maya smile sit upon the carpet beside me. I know you work very hard, Bobo, all the days and almost all the nights of the week. I look at my son, at his brown eyes that on a woman would be beautiful, and in Farsi I thank him for his apology and for the tea, and I tell to him he must begin preparing his room for moving. Today, on the freeway crew of garbage soldiers, we work the southbound lanes of Route 101, where it runs along the tall evergreen trees of the Golden Gate Recreational Area. I wear my new blue hat all the day long, but of course the morning fog never lifts, and I wish for a light sweater. At the lunch break, I eat quickly beside Tran, then rise to speak with Torres as he sits behind the wheel of his truck, the door open very wide, as he studies one of those odd crossword grids in the newspaper. I stand there a moment until it becomes clear to me I am standing at attention. I discipline myself to relax my shoulders and speak. After today, I will no longer be working here, Mr. Torres. He completes writing a word with his pencil. Then he looks up and says, "You tell the office, Coronel?" "No." "So why tell me, man?" He regards his newspaper. "You know another word for hurricane?" I return to Tran in my tea, and I have a wish to tell the Vietnamese goodbye. But when I point to my chest, then to the road, he smiles and nods his head as if I were telling to him a very old and humorous story. And now it is evening at the convenience store, and my legs are heavy, my eyes are beginning to water from fatigue, but I am filled with cheer as I work my very last shift. Rico, the young man working beside me, has always possessed the habit of chewing gum, which on other evenings bothered me a great deal, that nasty sound it makes in the mouth. But tonight this is not the case. None of the usual irritants have their power over me. Not the bright fluorescent lighting over all the shelves of overpriced boxed and canned food. Not the university students who enter with their stupid smiles after drinking too much beer to purchase chocolate bars and cigarettes. Not even when people hand to me a gasoline credit card and I have to use the cumbersome machine beneath the magazine display rack. And even those cassif and dirty magazines of naked women on their covers, which I have always despised having to touch or sell, even they cannot upset me as they have so many times before. Because this I know of life's difficult times. There is always a time for them to begin and a time for them to end. And the man who knows this knows he must thank God for each day he has suffered, because that is always one day closer to the sun, the real sun. But many nights, after many long days in America, I have forgotten God and thought only of my troubles, of the manner of jobs I was forced to work here, jobs I would not have assigned a soldier under me back in my old life. Here I have worked in a tomato cannery, an auto wash, a furniture warehouse, a parking lot, 2 gasoline stations, and finally the highway department and this convenience store. Yes, I have earned enough to slow our spending, but each check cashed felt to me like one less bone and muscle in my back, those a man needs in order to stand straight. My young colleague and I closed the store promptly at 1 in the morning. We lock the evening's receipts into the small safe in the rear office, and we post our inventory sheet for the day, gentlemen, before removing our paychecks from the coin drawer of the register. We lock the doors and walk beneath the light over the gasoline pumps to our vehicles, and to the young man I only say, "Good night, Rico," nothing more. And as I drive my Buick Regal down San Pablo Avenue beneath the streetlights so early in the morning, my body feels sewn into the car seat with tiredness, but I nod 5 times to the east and thank God, my mouth beginning to tremble, for the freedom he has granted me once again, for the return of the dignity I was beginning to believe I would never recover.
Friday was the best and worst day so far. It was best because I worked it straight through, cleaning my normal residential plus the reservoir house job and the pediatric office I'd skipped the day before. There was a fog bank pushing in from the beaches, and on another day it could have sent me over the edge, the way it covers the town in gray. But Friday I just tuned it out and cleaned with more energy than I'd had in a long time. My customers leave me a key in their mailbox or under a rock on their lawn, which means no one is ever there except for a dog or cat, and I can work alone and fast, chewing gum and listening to the Walkman I keep clipped to my shorts, Nick's old tapes mostly, loud, fast rock that keeps me moving at a good pace and keeps me from thinking too much. When I woke up early Friday morning at the El Rancho, I made up my mind I was going to stop wallowing in my problem and start concentrating on the solution instead. I had to turn it over to Connie Walsh. She was my lawyer. By the time I was dressed, I'd convinced myself I'd hear something positive by the end of the day about getting my house back. So instead of booking my room through the weekend, I went down to the office and paid another $31 for Friday night only. I got back to the motel just before the end of the work week traffic heated up on the freeways. My arms, legs, and lower back were tired out, and my sweat had dried 3 times on my skin. But before I took a shower, I called legal aid, and Gary had me wait on the line almost 5 minutes before Connie Walsh picked it up. "I'm sorry, Kathy, but evidently the county has already sold your house." I stood still and took short, dry breaths. "What? How?" "The auction date's been set for months, Kathy. That was in the mail you've been throwing away." I pictured my mother's round face, her eyes dark and flat-looking. I heard my brother Frank, who told me and Nick the house was ours as far as he was concerned. He might want his half in 20 years, but hey, Kay, one day at a time, right? Then I felt the tears come, my stomach twisting up. Those motherfuckers. "Can you get that to me Monday morning, Kathy?" "What?" "Your copy of the tax statement. Hopefully I'll have their paperwork by then, and we can go from there, all right?" Connie Walsh was quiet on the other end. I wiped my nose and asked her what she was planning to do. "Just what I said, Kathy. We'll demand they rescind the sale or we file a lawsuit against the county." She said not to worry too much, then reminded me to get that paperwork to her Monday morning. I spent the first part of the night in the steel storage shed across the street looking for the signed tax statement from the county. But it was already too dark to see much, and I didn't have a flashlight, so I drove to a convenience store on the other side of the freeway to get one. The streets were fogged in, and the air was wet and too cool for shorts. Back in the shed, I found one of Nick's old sweatshirts and pulled it on. It was black and white, with the logo of a band he used to play bass for years ago. It was clean, so didn't smell like him, but I could still picture him in it, lying on the couch while he read a paperback with the TV or radio on, sometimes both. That was always how he read. After over an hour going through my boxes and bags, my neck stiff from holding the butt of the flashlight between my chin and chest so I could use both hands, I almost gave up when I remembered my trunk. I pulled 2 full trash bags off it, then lifted the heavy wooden lid. Inside were things I hadn't even looked at since moving west. Old clothes and shoes, towels and blankets, 12 rock albums from high school, mainly the Rolling Stones and the Allman Brothers. But no paperwork. "Hello?" I screamed and swung around and dropped the flashlight. A man picked it up and shined it in his face. It was shadowed and I stepped back, but then I recognized the crooked mustache. Deputy Sheriff Burden smiled, then handed me the flashlight, and I took a breath and let it out. "Shit! Don't do that!" "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to scare you." "Well, you did. I put the pictures back in the trunk, then stepped out of the shed and padlocked it, squeezing the flashlight between my ribs and elbow. My heart was still beating fast, and it was completely dark now. Fog hovered in the lot and street. In the light from the security lamps over the sheds, I could see Lester Burden was wearing jeans and sneakers and a windbreaker. "Did you get hold of legal aid?" "Yeah, thanks." I turned off the flashlight and began to walk across the lot. My bare legs felt cold. My nipples were hard against my shirt. I didn't know how I felt about him being here. "You working undercover or something?" "Excuse me?" He looked down at his sneakers. "Oh, no, I'm off. I drive by this way. I thought I'd check in on you, see how you're holding up." He sounded like he meant it, and he seemed even softer than the day before when he'd led those men in, kicking me out of my house. When we got to his car, a Toyota station wagon parked at the edge of the lot near the chain-link fence, I kind of hoped he'd keep talking. Connie Walsh was the first person I'd had a real conversation with in over 8 months, and that was more of an interrogation than a talk. I wanted one, even with a sheriff's deputy in the fog. He was looking across the street, past the motel, to all the tractor trailers parked behind the truck stop. I could hear the bass drum of the country band through the walls, cars moving over the freeway bridge down the block. He looked back at me, his face all somber. "Can I buy you a cup of coffee or something?" "That'd be all right." I told him I had to put on something warmer first. He waited in his car in the motel lot, and I changed into the same clothes I'd worn to legal aid. I rubbed some deodorant under my arms and ran some eyeliner under my bottom lashes. We both agreed the truck stop would be too loud, so we ended up at a Carl's Jr., a mile past the freeway on the outskirts of San Bruno. The place was brightly lit and smelled like fried chicken and potatoes. I hadn't eaten and my stomach felt hollow, but I didn't want to order food and change the offer of drinking coffee together into something else. We sat at a table by the window. Deputy Burden had taken off his jacket and was wearing a striped golf shirt. His arms were tan, and the gold of his wedding band stood out bright against his skin. His mustache was as crooked as it had been the day before, his dark eyes a little moist. I had to be looking at the most serious man I'd ever met. Our coffee came. I added sweet and low to mine, but he sipped his black, his eyes on me. On the ride over, he'd asked me if legal aid had a lawyer for me yet, and I told him yeah. Then Connie Walsh's news about the county already auctioning off the house. Now he looked down at the tabletop and shook his head. "Boy, they don't fool around, do they? It's not hard to rescind these things, though, is it? That's my lawyer's plan." I felt shaky at his reaction. I lifted my coffee cup, but then put it back down. I felt a little sick to my stomach. I lit a cigarette and blew the smoke out the side of my mouth. "I really don't know much about that, Mrs. Lazaro." "Kathy." "Niccolo's my maiden name." "It suits you." His eyes stayed on mine a second, then he glanced out the window. I wanted to ask if he had any kids. I wanted to know that, but I didn't ask, and took a drag of my cigarette. "Anyway, we never should have been charged a tax at all, and I only own half the house in the first place. My lawyer's confident, though, so I'm trying not to harp on the negative. Your husband hold the rest?" "My brother. He doesn't know about any of this yet. No one does." The waitress came by and topped off our coffee. Lester Burden smiled at her, but sadly, I thought, like he knew something about her that wasn't good. His face changed when he saw me studying him, and he sipped his coffee. "Do you have any kids, Mr. Burden?" "2. He put his cup down and folded his elbows on the table. His eyes were on mine again, but this time he didn't look away, and neither did I. I wasn't used to being looked at so closely, to being seen. "My husband left me 8 months ago. No one back home knows that either." "You always keep so many secrets?" "Just when I have to." He kept his brown eyes on me, and I looked away to stub out my cigarette. "I understand." "Do you?" "I think so." He nodded once, the way cops do. It was a short and strange ride back to the motel. Neither of us talked, and the fog still moved slowly through the streets. The lights over the diesel pumps at the truck stop looked misted at the edges. So did the blue and red neon beer signs in the bar window. And across the lot, the tall yellow letters of the El Rancho Motel over the office all dulled and spread out a little. He pulled into the lot, and I put my hand on the door handle. I want to go back to my house, but I'd have to break a window just to get in there. He touched four fingers to my knee, lifting them just as quick, but they left a warmth in my leg that loosened something in me all the way to my diaphragm. Do you mind if I give you some professional advice? I guess not. Keep your head and do it all through your lawyer, Kathy. If I were you, I wouldn't even drive up there until the keys were back in my hand. He looked dark-eyed and somber again, and I didn't want to get out of his car, but I didn't want to stay either. Thanks for stopping by. He looked at me with his handsome face and crooked mustache, and I got out and closed the door, watching his little station wagon turn up the foggy street, its taillights vanishing in no time. Saturday and Sunday, all the coast towns were fogged in. I spent the weekend in my room smoking and reading magazines, watching my own color TV I'd pulled from the storage shed. When I got hungry, I went out for fast food. Late Sunday night, I drove under the freeway to go buy cigarettes and a Snickers bar, and when I got back, I couldn't be sure, but I thought I saw Lester Burden's car pull away from the curb across the street, its small, foreign engine straining to shift gears.
I look at my Nadi over the pizza we are eating upon the floor of our new home. She is dressed in a fashionable sweatsuit the color of roses. She wears no cosmetics upon her face, and there are shadows beneath her eyes. Esmail has worked very hard all weekend, and he reaches for a fifth slice even before he has finished chewing his last. But Nadire will not return my look. She has spoken to me very little, in Farsi or English, since I yelled and broke her cassette player by throwing it in the bedroom of our Puldar apartment. We complete our eating, and I give my son permission to leave the sofre for his room. Nadi rises to prepare the samovar. The movers finished with their business by nightfall yesterday, my wife working until midnight bringing order to her new room, the largest, with two good windows overlooking the rear lawn. My room and Esmail's are smaller and face the front grass and the street and woodland beyond, and we will share the bathroom as a family. Even though she would not speak to me, I enjoyed listening to Nadi talk with the large moving men in English, informing them please to be calculated and please to work slowful and avoid to shatter very supreme furniture, thank you, sirs. I lie back upon one elbow on the carpet, but I can no longer see my wife in the kitchen area due to the bar counter and its stools. This is something quite Western, the design of a drinking saloon in one's own home, and if I were not planning to sell the property to Americans, I would have it removed. The sound of televised laughter comes from Esmail's new bedroom. Yesterday he was excited to discover this hill brought as many programs to his screen as the Puldar apartments. And for 2 hours today, after he had organized his room, my son rode his skateboard down the long hill of Bisgrove Street again and again, those miniature wheels sounding on the road like a quite distant F-16 in the clouds. Nadi rests the tea and sugar at my bare feet, then quickly removes the empty pizza container and returns to the kitchen, which he has been putting into order all the afternoon. Upon the sofa are unpacked boxes, lamps, folded drapes, and blankets. She is reserving this room for last, which is good, for I know she has enough work to keep her busy for at least the first week. Fardo, tomorrow, I will for her purchase a new cassette player, and even a new tape or two, Gugush perhaps, that Ziba Persian woman who is a less sentimental singer than Dariush. I rise and carry my tea out the front door and walk barefoot upon the grass. The blades are long, at least 2 centimeters, and as I walk around to the side of the house, I make a note to purchase a grass cutter as well, something used, nothing extravagant. The sky has lost most of its light, and my new neighbors have turned on the lamps in their homes. I was disappointed there was no sun all the weekend long, only that strange, cool fog, but I am grateful for the tall hedge bushes around our little bungalow, and I like the heavy smell of pine they release into the air. Through the kitchen window I can barely see my Nadi working, for she has turned on no light. Tomorrow begins my new work, that of buyer and seller. I will give it the best hours of the day, like any office position. And that is what I must do with my room. Arrange it with a proper desk and chair and a telephone and perhaps a typewriter as well. But first, I must become a seller. I must double my investment with a buyer very soon. And of course, this must be handled more delicately than anything else. I cannot push Nadi too far too quickly, asking her to pack and move again so immediately. Perhaps I should wait a month or two for her to settle herself here, away from all the lying and play-acting of our life at the high-rise of our ruling Puldar. But will it not be more difficult, after I sell the home on the open market for a fair price, to ask her to move once again? But then I will of course be able to show her $80,000 or $90,000 in our hands, the opportunity to purchase another auction property to sell for profit, or even begin a business of some kind right away. I regard the slope of the roof above me, the sky growing quite dark, and I decide to telephone a Najjar as well, a carpenter, to give a price for the building of a widow's walk. I can then refer to this bungalow as Waterview property, and in the meanwhile, my wife and I may sit together in the early evenings, so high on the house and hill, to look out at the sea and the sky. The Najjar is a polite young man, not quite 30 years, and he has given to me a price of $1,100 for the construction of a widow's walk. We will not be able to enter this from inside the home, but must walk outdoors to new stairs in front of the kitchen window in order to reach the roof. There is no other affordable way to construct it, the Najjar assures me, so I accept this compromise, but I will not inform Nadire of her window. This morning, Monday, while my son rides his skateboard down the hill of Bisgrove Street to explore the town of Corona in the sunshine, I spend time here in my new room, organizing it as an office, and I have no time to waste. As soon as I rid my desk of all unnecessary papers and boxes, I begin immediately to write an advertisement for the sale of this house. I study the language used in other realty advertisements of the town's newspaper, and I use the same for my own, yet I do not feel I am qualified to name a price. So many of the homes advertised sound no larger or more well-maintained than this bungalow, and they are in quiet residential areas as well. But the prices for these homes are well over $170,000. My fingers begin to shake. I am once again in amazement at the low price I paid for the home, and I imagine if I could sell for even $150,000, I would more than triple my investment. Outside my door and down the hallway, Nadi works in the living room area. From time to time, I am able to hear her voice as she speaks to herself. It is a habit she has always possessed, and I am pleased to hear it, for it only comes when she is deeply involved with a project or task of some kind. Early this morning, she rose from her bed with the rest of us, her son and I. She for us prepared toast and tea, and when she poured for me, I thanked her, and she said, Khayshmi konam Behrani, which is the proper response, though I have never cared for her using my family name when addressing me. When we were younger, she called me Masujun, or often Mas. But for many years now, since the revolution, I am quite certain, my Nadi has called me Behrani. One evening, in our large apartment in Paris, on the right bank of that dirty but beautiful river, the Seine, Nadi had a long telephone conversation with one of her sisters in Tehran. After hanging up, she began immediately crying. I gave her a few moments of solitude, then I went to comfort my wife, but she pushed me away and yelled very loud in Farsi, she should have never married me, a Kasif soldier. None of her family were forced to leave the country. Their names are not upon a death list, just her, because she married me and the filthy Kasif Air Force, and it is all your fault, Behrani. Our country is ruined because of you, you and your Savak friends. It was then I hit my wife very hard across the face with my open hand, and she fell to the floor and lay there crying, Mamicham Bemiram. I want to die, she wept. I want to die. Of course, I would not have let her stay upon the carpet in that fashion if our son was in the home, but Ismail was playing in the streets with his young French friends, so I allowed Nadire to lie upon her face and weep. Because she was quite wrong of my involvement with the secret police, Savak. I had very little to do with any of their affairs. And of course, she before never complained of all our privileges. She never complained of the maids and soldiers she used for the upkeep of our home. She never complained of the skiing trips in the mountains to the north, or of our bungalow there overlooking the Caspian in Chaluz. She never complained of the fine gowns she was able to wear at the parties of generals and judges and lawyers and famous actors and singers. She never complained when on a Sunday afternoon I would order Bahman to drive our family to the finest movie house in Tehran, and of course there would be a long queue of people waiting. But I was dressed in my uniform, so we never waited. We never even paid. We were ushered up to the balcony reserved for the very important people away from the crowd. And yes, I often saw fear behind the smiles of these theater managers as they bowed and led us personally to our seats. And yes, no one waiting upon the sidewalk outdoors dared make a complaint I may hear. But there was no blood on my fingers. I purchased fighter jets. I was not with Savak. But there were moments in my career I had spent time with these men. In the final years, every Thursday evening, five or six of we senior officers would meet at General Porat's home for vodka and masvachiar. And how I have wished for that sort of company today. At the high-rise of Pouldah Persians in Berkeley, I attempted to organize some of the men together for an occasional evening, but these young doctors and engineers have spent so many of their years being educated in the West, they do not even know the proper way to drink with each other like men. They do not know that the oldest and most experienced in the room is the salgi, that he and only he holds the vodka bottle, and he will fill or not fill those cups around him. Each Thursday evening at Purat's, he, of course, was the salgi. In his large home, a soldier would escort us to the den, where we gentlemen would remove our shoes at the doorway, and we would sit in a circle on the dark red carpet from Tabriz. In winter, there was a fire burning in the tall stone fireplace behind us. Two or three musicians and a singer would stand in the far corner, softly playing songs more than 1,000 years old and still only a third as old as our country. Hanging on the east wall was a long woven tapestry of Hazrat Abbas and his holy companions charging down the sand hill of Karbala, racing to the thousands of enemy soldiers who would yield them to martyrdom. And in front of each of us was placed a small earthen cup, relics from Purat's family in Isfahan. A box of long Havana cigars lay closed, for we never smoked until our host did first, nor did we dip our two fingers into the chaser, as Americans might call it, the bowl of masvachiar, that wonderful sour yogurt mixed with bits of cucumber. That moment would not come until after our first drink of cold Russian vodka, which Purat would pour as soon as he entered in a smoking jacket, silk pants, and fine Parisian socks. He was a handsome man, khoshtip, and bald with wide shoulders and a flat belly. Of course we would stand, but Purat would wave us back to the floor, and he would make a joke about one of us, something he may have heard that week at Mehrabad, and we always laughed at Purat's jokes, not out of respect, but because he was truly an amusing man. Sometimes he would tease one of the younger or more ambitious men by passing his cup over while pouring the very first drink, something a salgi rarely did, for the main purpose of a salgi is to keep a man from drinking more than he is able. The young senior officer with the empty cup might lower his head out of shame, his face a reddened study in concentration, as he attempted to remember how he may have insulted the general. But then Purat would laugh quite loudly, as would the rest of us, and he would pour the vodka for the relieved and smiling young man, then fill all our cups. When we toasted our health, each man, including Purat, attempted to tap his cup beneath those of the others, which is a true sign of respect in Persia. Manukaratam, we say, meaning, I am your servant. And of course each man wants to honor another more than himself, if it is truly deserved, so he will not allow his cup to stay higher when they touch. He will instantly lower his cup to the bottom of the other man's, as if to say, no, I am your servant. But the other will sometimes insist by lowering his again, and more than once I have seen grown men lower their cups in this fashion, each after the other, all the way to the floor, then stand a fistfight over who respects whom the most. But at Puratz, this would never occur. We prided ourselves on being not simply high officers, but Persian gentlemen as well. One winter evening, General Purat invited a seventh man to his home, his nephew. He was dark-skinned and younger than us all, with not more than 33 or 34 years. He possessed good looks, the wide jaw, small nose, and deep eyes I would see in film actors, and his physique was quite fit and powerful-looking beneath his finely tailored dark suit. Each time he raised his vodka cup to drink, his upper arm muscle would bunch into a round stone. And when one of the men commented on the young man's power, Purat said, "Yes, Bijan outlasts them all at the Zurkhane." One of the older gentlemen seated beside me began to speak of his boyhood in Rasht, how he would go with his father to the Zurkhane and witness all the large men there, half naked and sweating, lifting the milos over their heads while the chanter sang and played the dombak drum in front of a fire, and the hot stones a boy would pour water over to bring on more steam. And I did not care for the fashion in which Purat's nephew listened to this story. He drank his vodka and dipped 3 fingers, not 2, into the masfahiyar, and as he licked his fingers clean, he would not even look at the older man speaking of his boyhood in Rasht. The young man kept his eyes on his stocking feet in front of him, as if he were hearing something for the 500th time, something he of course knew completely before he'd heard it the first. When the gentleman beside me finished telling the story of his father in the Zurkhane, Purat poured each of us more vodka, and when we raised our cups in a toast to our past and to our traditions, I watched to make sure the younger man, this Bijan, held his cup low out of respect, which he did, though his face appeared impassive, and it was plain for me to see that here was a boy who was not only accustomed to being admired and looked at and listened to, he expected it as well. "What is your nephew's position, Janob General Purat?" This was asked amiably by Mehran Hafsinjani, a small man who held a high rank and was a specialist in radar communications. The young man looked directly at Hafsinjani, and he insulted Purat, his uncle and host, by answering ahead of him, "I am with Savak, sir." Purat immediately made a joke to us all to watch our manners. "You never know what secrets these policemen have." But his nephew did not smile. He sat with his back erect, his thick arms resting at the wrist upon both knees, and he absently tapped 2 fingers on the carpet. "My Bijan was trained in America, in New York." The handsome Savaki shook his head in a pretended show of modesty. I leaned forward. "And what did they teach you there, young Mr. Purat?" I did not try to disguise the contempt in my voice, and my use of the word young Javun came out sounding like an insult, but I did not care. General Purat was my oldest friend. The vodka was warm in my belly. I was a colonel. The handsome nephew looked directly at my eyes. "They taught us techniques, Janob Sarhang." "What sort of techniques?" The young man surprised me. He glanced at his uncle to see if he should answer. Purat nodded slightly, the light of the fire in his eyes. "Torture, Janob Sarhang." "They teach you this in America?" said another gentleman, a big radish of a bureaucrat named Ali. "Among other things?" The trace of a smile passed over the young man's face. "I have heard some stories," said Ali. "We all have." He regarded General Purat and cleared his throat. "I heard of a man in the Tude party who was forced to watch his wife raped at the city prison." Young Purat waved his hand as if it a fly upon his nose. "That is only effective for so long. If you want real information, you must take their children. Make a subversive watch his little one lose a hand or arm, and they will tell you everything." He smiled, his eyes on his vodka cup upon the floor. "But the difficult part of the work is knowing whom to arrest." 2 men laughed. I had heard these stories as well. We all had. But I felt the vodka inside me turn cool. "Do you enjoy your work, Mr. Purat?" The Savaki narrowed his eyes immediately. "Enjoyment has nothing to do with it. I serve Shah and Shah, sir. I can only assume you do as well." The musicians had just completed a song and the room was quiet. A dry log crackled in the fire, then shifted in the coals. I felt the heat of my heart drop to my hands, and for a brief moment I imagined my thumbs buried in the young policeman's eyes. General Perrott clapped his hands twice.
All right, enough of this talk. You two surprise me. You are colleagues, you should act as such.
He turned to the musicians.
Play something festive.
The general poured us all more vodka, and the moment passed. Soon I was massed, half drunk with the others, and we lay back upon our elbows on the carpet to smoke cigars and listen to the music. Occasionally I would look over at the young torturer and see him gazing into the fire, his eyes empty, and I wished he would leave our group early and not come back, for I did not like to be reminded of the secret police and all the people they made disappear in our land, these students and professionals, wives, mothers, husbands, fathers, children, the literate Kagars living in small homes of mud and wood scraps less than a kilometer from the Grand Palace with all of its fine ornaments imported from around the world. I did not like to think once again that America, with whom I did close business in the purchase of fighter jets, had such a hand in all this. I did not like to think this was the manner in which our king retained his throne and our way of life, but, most of all, I did not want to accept that General Perrott was correct when he said the young policeman and I were colleagues. So once more, I drank more vodka than I should have, and the rest of the evening I did not dip my two fingers into the same bowl of masfahiar as the young torturer, Bijan. Behrani? My wife stands in the doorway. Since moving, she has dressed each morning in ladies' cotton trousers and a loose pullover shirt in which she can work. Over the last few months, she has lost too much weight. She wears a gold costume jewelry belt to hold her pants up, and her hips look as slim as a boy's. But she has applied cosmetics to her lips and eyes, and her thick hair is pulled up and back with a scarf.
Yes, Nadijan. When must we move again?
I take a breath. Not too soon. Perhaps once we get a buyer, we will tell him to wait until fall. Would you prefer that? She looks by me to the window, at the sun on our long grass, the road, the woodland beyond, her eyes becoming moist. I will do as you wish, Masood. I stand and hold my wife, and for a brief moment she allows this. I feel the softness of her chest against me. I smell her clean hair, the familiar scent of lavender and tea. But she steps away and walks quickly down the corridor to her work. Nadi has always had more pride than a queen, and I am certain what just happened between us was an apology. But as I sit at my desk, I feel that caged heaviness in my belly that comes with a failure of courage, for it is I who should apologize. It is I who have helped to fly us so far off course.
I was on Corona Beach, still wearing the shorts I'd worked in, leaning back on an El Rancho motel towel. The sky was clear and blue. No sign of the fog that can float in whenever it feels like it. The tide was low, and green waves curled in long and lazy, spreading out on the wet sand where four kids squatted, building a hill for a red plastic truck. My Monday job was a two-story duplex on the Como River. The owner was a quiet CPA who had custody of his 12-year-old daughter on the weekends. He had a beard and thick glasses, and once he left me a typed note asking me out, and I wrote in pencil on the bottom that I couldn't. I was married, which was true, though Nick had already been gone for months. The CPA wrote an apology in a second note, and I felt like a liar and a chicken shit, and he never wrote any more notes, just left the check under a rainbow magnet on the fridge. After cleaning his small house, I drove straight to the motel and called Connie Walsh. It took her almost 10 minutes to get to the phone, and when she did, she told me she was running late for court. She still hadn't heard from the county. Then she asked me to drop off my copy of the notarized tax statement. I told her I couldn't find it. She said that wasn't good news, but keep your chin up. It'll probably be in the records they're sending. And Kathy, I recommend you try and stay with friends. County bureaucrats are notorious for dragging their briefcases. This could take a few weeks to iron out. A few weeks? Yes, that's right. I was about to tell my lawyer that's too long, I can't afford it. But she hung up, and soon after the front desk lady buzzed my room and asked if I was checking out or staying another day. I didn't know where else to go, but I told her I was checking out. I packed my suitcase, then carried my TV across the street and locked it back in the storage shed. A trucker was backing his rig into the yard to turn around, and as I crossed the street again, he honked once, then stuck his head out the window, smiled hard, and said something to me I couldn't hear over his engine. I should have given him the finger, but instead I went back into my room and packed two of the motel's towels to take with me. Revenge, I guess, for the broken TV, though I never told him it was broken. Behind me, an engine with no muffler started up, and I turned to see an old Malibu pull out of the beach lot, a First Things First bumper sticker above its rusted tailpipe. Nick hated those 12-step, higher-power slogans, especially when they were on cars he'd see on his way to work or just running errands. "Big brother ruling you from somebody's fucking tailpipe," he'd say. "They're not rules, they're reminders." "They're fucking reminders to obey the rules, Kath." But I didn't feel that way. Every time I saw one, usually on a back bumper, I felt like when you're in a crowded city street and you see a face you knew once, and even if you don't talk to that person, you feel suddenly more tied to your past and present. When I was using, I never liked seeing them. But after the program, whenever I saw one, I felt a kind of sad attraction for whatever it had to say. Live and let live. Let go and let God, one day at a time, take it easy, keep it simple. Nick's the one who got me to stop going to meetings. In the program, they let you try both ways. AA, that says we're powerless over our addiction and have to give it up to something higher, and RR, which is based on the small book, which has only been around a few years and says we're not powerless, and thinking this just makes it easier to fail. All you have to do is recognize the beast in you, the addict, the enemy voice that wants to use, accuse it of malice against you, remind yourself what a worthwhile person you are and that you treasure your sobriety, and then it's not so hard to use all this against the beast and not let it get what it wants. And they spelled beast in capital letters. B equals boozing opportunity. E equals enemy voice recognition. A equals accuse the voice of malice, S equals self-control reminders, T equals treasure your sobriety. This all left me cold, like a foreign language I'd never be able to learn. It's where Nick went, though, so I went too. But I missed the few AA meetings I'd been to, everyone sitting in a cloud of their own smoke, telling their stories and backing each other up. Nobody any wiser or more together than anyone else. Nick loved the part about enemy voice recognition. On that 5-day drive west in our new car, hauling a tiny U-Haul trailer, he drank thermos after thermos of coffee, and he'd go on and on about how there's a part of all of us that wants to kill ourselves, Kay, even when things are going well, especially when things are going well. And the only way to beat it is with reason and rationality, like a mother or father with a young kid. And he'd smile and slap the steering wheel with both hands, looking over at me, his cheeks and chin bluish with whiskers. He was so sure about it, I wanted to believe it, too. But there was always that nagging pull inside me. I'd look back out at the rushing white lines of the highway, or else put the passenger seat back and close my eyes. It wasn't a problem for me to hear an enemy voice in my head and accuse it of malice. It was the next part, drawing on all that self-love everybody's supposed to have deep down, then telling yourself that life without getting high is better. That's what I could never do. And after the program, as I sat next to Nick at our weekly rational recovery groups in Cambridge, no one talked about being powerless and living life one day at a time, which was really more how I felt. Instead, we were powerful and rational, powerful because we were rational. And we talked about living life one life at a time. A lot of RR people had even given up smoking that way, so there was hardly an ashtray in the room, though there was coffee and we all seemed to drink a lot of it. I always left these meetings feeling like a fake. Nick didn't, though. We'd walk down the sidewalk across from the high brick walls of Harvard, and he'd grab my hand and then kiss my neck, pulling me along, telling me there was a little voice in his pants he could only accuse of love. Sometimes we'd walk down to Harvard Square to eat or see a movie. I always wanted to do both. Eat something heavy and delicious like lasagna or prime rib, then go to the small theater past the newsstand and all the teenagers in loose pants to snuggle down into the red seats in the dark with a large Coke and about 10 chocolate peanut butter cups. Just let the flickering light of the story shut up my rational, reasonable voice for a couple of hours. But then the lights would always come up, and I'd blink to see Nick sitting beside me in a funk. Very few of the movie characters had control of any of their impulses and problems, and Nick said it was too depressing and exhausting for him to watch. So we stopped going to movies on RR nights. Soon we left the East Coast. So many nights after Nick left, I'd just get into the Bonneville and drive. I'd drive up the coast and down the coast, and I was always looking for that gray Honda. Most of the time I knew he was far away, though sometimes I pictured him living in a neighborhood less than 10 miles from Bisgrove Street, playing bass in a band maybe, living alone or with a 20-year-old girl who had no intention of saddling him with kids, saddling him with anything. I'd still feel a little sick whenever I thought of him with somebody else. But I was sure if he was with somebody, she had to be young enough he could mold her into what he wanted. He was such a chicken shit. And I didn't even know this until he'd been gone almost 2 months. I got the insight while I watched a rented movie. That's what I did almost every night, right up until Deputy Lester Burden showed up to evict me. I'd rent 2 or 3 movies and watch them back to back. Sometimes I'd even start in the late afternoon. Including weekends, I averaged close to 20 a week. I knew how addictive this might look to anyone back in the program, or in RR, but I wasn't putting anything into my body, not even cigarettes then, so I rationalized there was no real enemy voice to accuse of malice, was there? It was a porno I grabbed from the adult section and slipped in with 2 PG-13s. I read once that over 95% of men masturbate while only 46% of women do. And I'd always thought I was somewhere on the borderline. I did it once every few months, not enough to ever miss. But when I put in the video cassette and heard the electric moan of the recorder pulling the tape along, I was already wet and there was still daylight outside. So I went around and pulled all the shades, turned off the light in the kitchen, then sat on the floor as the credits came up yellow with names like Fiona Lace and John Rod. And before they were over, a young blonde girl was on her knees sucking off a tanned Italian in a shirt, tie, and suspenders. I had seen skin flicks before, but not many, usually at parties where I was too loaded to see. So I was a little surprised when they started to fuck and I didn't feel like unzipping my jeans. Instead, I sat back against the couch with my ankles and arms crossed and watched as the man directed the blonde to do this and do that, to bend over his desk so he could spread her cheeks and enter her from behind. Then I pictured my husband jerking off to this, and I felt my stomach and insides get pulled down a second, and I jabbed the eject button and flung the tape behind me without looking. I went outside to my backyard. It was March then, and chilly. The ground was hard, and I stared at it. Nicky was a good lover. He didn't fuck like those men. He didn't direct me like a rag doll to probe. It had always seemed mutual to me. But what was so clear to me for the first time was this. When all was said and done, Nick Lazzaro had to have total control. It was close to noon and the sun was getting too hot on my legs and face. I stood and brushed the sand off, and after a fast food lunch of a fish sandwich and Diet Coke, I drove back to the storage lot to look for that signed tax statement again. But there were no air vents in the shed, and even with the doors swung wide open, it was so hot in there my tank top and shorts were stuck to my skin in just a few minutes, and my throat needed another cold drink. I padlocked the door, put the air conditioner on in the car and just started driving. I was kicking myself for not taking a shower before checking out of the El Rancho. I turned into a gas station, filled the tank on my gas card, and gave myself a cat bath from the sink in the ladies' room. Then I changed into a clean cotton pullover, bought more cigarettes, and drove 12 miles south on 101 to a mall cineplex. There were 10 movie theaters there, and I was planning to sit the afternoon away in at least 3 of them.
I do not know if it was the glass of champagne my Nadi drank, or if it was because Ismail had fallen asleep early before his television in his room, or if it was simply the joyful news of the real estate appraiser who I hired to come here yesterday, the news I thank God for and cannot yet believe, that this bungalow is worth 4 times what I paid for it, and the appraiser sees no difficulty in our finding a buyer for it, especially with the new widow's walk that will overlook the sea. Perhaps it was that, or the new cassette player I purchased for her at Japantown in San Francisco late yesterday afternoon. I do not know. My name is Dunam. All I can be certain of is yesterday God kissed our eyes, and last evening my wife invited me to her room for only the 3rd time in the years we have lived in America. We lay together in the darkness, listening to a new cassette of a singer reciting the Rubaiyats of Fayez Dashtestani. Behind this, a man softly played the ney, a shepherd's flute, and soon she pulled me to her, and it was almost too much. I felt I was a young man again, lying with my new bride. Nadi held my back so tightly, and I saw again my father on our wedding day carrying the fat sheep to the doorway of our new home. It was summer and very hot, and because of the west wind there was dust upon our fine clothes. My father wore a suit of black, and his forehead and cheeks were shining with sweat as he carried the sheep under his left arm, the long knife in his right hand, and he knelt and held the sheep at the open doorway, the sheep beginning to bleat, struggling and kicking beneath my father's weight, Nadi squeezing my hand in both of hers as my father pushed the blade deep into the sheep's throat, pulling it free, letting the blood fall onto the threshold of our new home, Nadi's father squatting and rubbing the blood into the wood with his fingers. Behind us, the women and men clapping, and a hot wind blowing over us all, Nadi's breath upon my neck, the crowd pushing us into the dark house past the dying sheep, its rear legs twitching and jerking in the dust. The shepherd's flute continued. My wife moved to rest my face upon her shoulder, and she rubbed her fingers gently on the skin of my head as if I were her own child. Soon the music ended and she was asleep, but I could not sleep. I went to Ismail's room and turned off the television. Then I covered him with his sheet. Even curled there, his body took up nearly all the bed. He is growing so quickly, faster than did his sister Saraya, that standing before him in my robe, I felt proud and frightened all at the same moment. And now I wake upon the living room sofa just before the sun, and I feel a sadness that I did not stay in bed with Nadire, for I do not know if last evening will come again any time soon. And I remember Saraya when she was a girl. Her legs were long and thin and brown, and her mother forever had her wearing a pretty dress of some kind. One evening, upon my return home, when she had no more than 7 or 8 years, I remember my daughter stepping out onto the rear veranda to greet me. I heard her laughing, and I looked up from the auto and saw her standing at attention in her yellow dress, her tiny knees barely touching one another, wearing the visored hat from my old Sarvon's uniform. The captain's hat was, of course, so large it fell forward and covered her eyes, and I remember that lovely gap between her 2 front teeth as she laughed and saluted, even though she could not see me or anything else. She is now a man's wife. At this thought, I rise from the couch, dress, and take my tea outside to the rear lawn. The tall grass is slightly wet, and it begins to itch my bare feet as I walk around the bungalow with my hot cup. It is still quite early. Stars are visible in the sky. Today, the young Najjar begins construction of the widow's walk, and I do not know if it was perhaps a mistake to begin advertising the sale of the home before the job is complete. I lower my eyes to the dark woodland across the road, and I stop still. For parked there beside the trees is the appraiser's red automobile. I feel a sudden lightness in my chest and a heaviness in my legs. I am certain he has driven here to inform me it is all a mistake. This bungalow is not worth anything. But as I step over the hard, cool road, I am embarrassed at my fear, at my doubt. The car is quite new-looking, and not the appraiser's at all, and of course he would not drive out for business at so very early in the morning. Purat many times told to me I was not a man of faith, and of course I was forced to agree with him. It is why I am forever expecting disaster around the corner from God's smile. There is a slight movement within the automobile. I approach and peer through the window glass to see a young woman sleeping upon her back in the front seat. She is dressed in short pants and a shirt without sleeves. Her arm rests over her eyes. I look in the rear window, but she is alone. Once again, I shake my head at how these American women live. I look once more at her naked legs and feet, then I return to my yard with my tea.
The sky is dark, and Nikki is on a brown horse, standing in a stream. I'm there too, knee-deep in water. He sits in the saddle, looking down at me the way he did the morning he left, like it's too late to do anything, and he's made up his mind to leave right away before he gets too sad about it all and won't be able to move. Except his horse won't move. It keeps looking at me with its big eyes. Every time Nick jerks on the reins, the horse opens its mouth and lets out a high-pitched whir. And when Nick kicks its ribs with his heels, it sounds like a rock hitting a hollow tree. I put my hand on the horse's damp neck and look up at Nick. Then everything changes, and he and I are sitting on a couch somewhere, both smoking, me pleading about wanting a baby, Nick sitting so still and quiet, looking straight ahead like I've just asked him to drink cyanide. I can hear the horse outside, the whirring and knocking. But who's the rider? Who is the rider? I opened my eyes and sat up in the front seat of the Bonneville. I could taste last night's cigarettes, and I turned the ignition key halfway to light up the digital clock. It wasn't quite 8 in the morning, but already the sun was coming warm through the windshield and on the maroon upholstery and me. The woods were thick and shaded as always, and deep inside were spots of sunlight. Then I heard the sound that had been in my sleep, and I turned and looked across the street at the house. Two carpenters were up on the roof above my kitchen. They were both shirtless, and one of them was ripping away shingles with the claw of his hammer while the other was using his power saw to cut through my roof, my father's roof, Frankie's roof. Their pickup truck was parked in front of the house, close to the driveway, where last night I saw a new white Buick in the shine of my headlights as I drove up the hill, but now it was gone, and I should have listened to Lester Burden and stayed away from here. But it was the only place I could think to go so late at night after driving around for over an hour, talking myself out of checking into another motel somewhere. Now the two carpenters stood together and used crowbars to pry a huge square of my roof off. They let it fall to the ground. Then they stood on the floor of my attic between the rafters. The one with the saw started cutting right into one of them, and I scooted behind the wheel and jerked open the door and ran across the street barefoot. I yelled up at them, but they couldn't hear me over the saw, so I stepped around my roof and climbed up the ladder. They were both tan, and one of them had a tattoo of a diner on his shoulder. The other one stopped cutting and looked from me to the one with the tattoo, then back at me again. "What are you doing?" The one with the tattoo dropped his hammer into his tool belt. "Excuse me? Who said you could do this? This is my fucking house." He peered over the roof down at his truck and my car. "And you are?" "I own this house. Me. Get off my roof." "Are you Mrs. Barani?" "No." The other carpenter reached into his apron, shook a cigarette from its pack, and lit it. I could feel him looking at my bare arms and legs, and at my hair all ratty from sleep. It was cold last night, and now my head felt stopped up, and I felt so out of place and wrong. "Mr. Barani hired me. You'll have to talk to him." I looked from the tattooed carpenter to the one smoking his cigarette. He glanced away from me and took in the view, and I turned and saw the rooftops of Corona below. Then the green-gray ocean stretching out from the beach to the horizon. Somehow this made me madder, and I climbed back down the ladder and began stepping over the shingles, and one of the carpenters yelled to watch out for nails just as I stepped on the upside-down plywood, where dozens of nail points were sticking out, and now four or five of them were sinking into the heel and ball of my foot. I screamed, jerking my knee up, the blood dripping. Shit! I hopped and sat down, then twisted my foot up, but there was so much blood I couldn't see where the holes were. Fuck! Here, the tattooed carpenter squatted in front of me and tied a bandana tight around my ankle. He helped me stand and guided me to the front steps, my front steps, and he knocked on the screen door. I had my hand on his bare shoulder, my elbow against his back. His skin was warm and damp, and I could feel the muscle under it. I was thinking how I hadn't brushed my teeth or washed my face, that I'd slept in my car last night and now was bleeding on my own doorstep waiting for a stranger to answer. A black-haired boy came to the door. He was maybe 15, and he wore bright orange surfer shorts and a loose t-shirt. He glanced down at my foot I wasn't letting touch the ground. A woman came up behind him. She had short, thick hair and dark eyes with hardly any makeup. She was wearing a designer sweatsuit, and there was a big ring on her left hand. I wanted to say that she was in my goddamn house, that she had no fucking right to remodel it, but the carpenter spoke up first and asked her if we could use the bathroom to wash my foot, and if she had something we could use to keep the blood from getting on her rug. And it was her rug. I could see it on the wall-to-wall carpeting behind her, a huge, deep red and brown Persian rug. The woman told the boy something in what sounded Arabic or Israeli, and the boy went to the kitchen and came back with a plastic trash bag he handed to the carpenter, who bent down and pulled it loosely over my foot. I felt like throwing up, my stomach contracting. The woman was looking at my hair and face, my wrinkled shirt, and her eyes seemed so full of caring I took a weak breath and didn't say anything as she stepped back and let the carpenter and me inside. I had one arm on the carpenter's shoulder, the other holding the plastic trash bag onto my foot. We passed a silver coffee table with bowls of nuts and wrapped chocolates set on top of it. There was a plush sofa and expensive-looking lamps. The carpenter stopped at the kitchen and asked the woman where the bathroom was, but before she could talk, I told him to go all the way down the hall. I leaned on his shoulder and hopped through a house that didn't seem like mine anymore. The door to my bedroom was open, and I caught a glimpse of a queen-size bed with brass posts. On the floor near the windows were huge potted green plants, and on the carpet around the bed were small rugs, deep purple, green, and black. In the bathroom, I sat on the edge of the tub and let cold water run over the sole of my foot as I watched the blood swirl down the drain. The carpenter stood beside me with his hands on his hips. He still had his tool belt on and his hammer handle was swaying against his leg. "When's the last time you had a tetanus shot?" "Is she yet bleeding?" The woman reached by me, her arm brushing my face, and I smelled lavender and cotton. She knelt on the floor, adjusted the water temperature, then took a bar of soap and washed my foot under hot water. She called to her son in their language. Then she sat on the edge of the tub, gently took my foot, and swung it to rest in a towel in her lap. It was a white towel, thick and soft, like only five-star hotels use, and I started to pull my bleeding foot from it. "Is it too hurting so much?" She looked into my eyes with hers that were so dark, the lines in her face delicate-looking, like she hadn't had them long. "I don't want to ruin your towel." She smiled, but I don't think she understood what I said. Her son came to the room with a box of cotton balls and a roll of ace bandage. He said something to her. Arabic, I decided. Then he said to me, with no accent at all,